Welcome back to the London Futurists podcast. Our guest in this episode is Adam Kovacevic. Adam is the founder and CEO of the Chamber of Progress, which describes itself as a centre-left tech industry policy coalition that works to ensure that all citizens benefit from technological leaps and that the tech industry operates responsibly and fairly. Adam has had a front row seat for more than 20 years in the tech industry's political maturation, and he advises companies on navigating the challenges of political regulation. For example, Adam spent 12 years at Google, where he led a 15-person policy, strategy, and external affairs team. In that role, he drove the company's US public policy campaigns on topics such as privacy, security, antitrust, intellectual property, and taxation. We have two reasons to want to talk with Adam today. First, to understand the kerfuffle that has arisen from the lawsuit launched against Apple by the US Department of Justice and 16 state attorney generals. And second, to look ahead to possible future interactions between tech industry regulators and the industry itself, especially as concerns about artificial intelligence rise in the public mind. Adam, welcome to the London Futurists podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us, Adam.
Adam, to add to the brief information about you in the introduction, what else should our audience know about you?
I got my start in U.S. Democratic Party politics in the late 90s. And my first experience working in politics was for my hometown congressman from California, who was one of the leaders of what was called the New Democrats in the House. They were very much the moderate Democrats in the Clinton-Gore mold. One of the issues that they were really excited to work on, they were among the first Democrats to work on, was technology policy issues. That opened my eyes to the tech industry and all the exciting things it was doing, in the way it was becoming a more and more important export for the U.S. around the world. That got me on a path of being interested in the tech industry. As you said, I spent 12 years at Google, but it always sort of felt to me that Democrats in the U.S. felt like tech was their industry. Republicans had the energy industry and Wall Street. Democrats had tech. Even Obama. I remember President Obama as a candidate visiting Google headquarters and saying something like he viewed himself as like the Google of candidates. He wanted to be associated with Silicon Valley. That all really changed when Trump got elected. I noticed a distinct change among Democrats. For some Democrats, they began to feel like, well, we have this long honeymoon with the tech industry and now we want a divorce. It just struck me as a very abrupt transition and frankly, not really even in line with where most Democratic voters were about tech, which was still feeling positively, feeling aspirational, would love to have more tech in their lives. I wanted to close that gap. So a lot of what we've done in our organization is to say to Democrats, actually, your Democratic voters and constituents are not nearly as ready to take up pitchforks against the tech industry as maybe some on the far left are.
On the subject of taking up pitchforks against the tech industry, before we dive into the actual case against Apple, do you have any sympathy with moves in government in the past to clip the wings of large tech companies such as IBM or Microsoft or others?
I know less about the IBM case, but I think certainly the Microsoft case from the 90s, one of the big differences, I think, between that case and what we see in modern day tech antitrust, I think there were probably two big differences. One, Windows market share in operating systems was 90% plus. It had a massive market share. That's not the case what we see, for example, the recent case with Apple in iOS versus Android. And I think the second aspect of this is that Microsoft had very clearly written into its contracts exclusionary behavior. So they said, if you want to have Windows, you cannot install a rival browser. That is also, I think, an element that we haven't seen as much in some of these recent cases. I do think it was different. One thing that is interesting to me is that sometimes you hear people talk today about tech monopolies, plural, monopolies. Once you speak about them plural, there may not be a monopoly anymore. In reality, what I see is the big four or five companies, Apple, Amazon, Google, Meta, Microsoft, invading each other's spaces in a very positive, pro-competitive way, which is that there's almost a paranoia, a healthy paranoia, about not wanting to be left behind when new technological trends come up. And so they all copy each other. They get into each other's spaces. By the way, that competition is good. That's good for consumers when you see almost kind of that cloning. So I have to laugh when people decry tech monopolies, plural. That plural may undercut the first part of the concern.
I completely agree with that. These companies are obviously intensely rivalrous. I'd love to know why you think that the intellectual wing of the left fell out of love with the tech industry when Trump came to power.
Sure. I think there are a variety of reasons why I think they fell out of love. And I wouldn't say it was everybody. I think it was the far left. Part of it was, for some, in a very caricatured way, they thought, oh, well, the internet was this wonderful thing we used to elect Barack Obama. He was pioneering in use of the internet. And then in 2016, the internet was this thing that the Russians used to elect Trump. And I'm talking about almost the broadest caricature possible. And I think that was certainly part of it. I also think that, to be fair to the Democrats, tech went from being a small, novel, cute, cuddly industry to among the most powerful industry. So it's natural that there'd be questions. My bigger concern is that the way we approach regulation of long-established industries, airlines and hospitals and drugs, is you see policymakers debate an idea, sometimes for quite a long time before they implement it. And they really try to debate the pros and cons. What's the problem they see? What's the correct intervention? What are the pros and cons of that intervention? What I saw happening from 2016 was an attitude among some Democrats where they said, look, we were completely hands-off on tech for a long time. Now we have to engage. We just need to do something, anything. I think it would be better to get to a place where we have a healthy conversation where we debate pros and cons. Right now, what I see is this sense of, no, we shouldn't debate the pros and cons of an idea too much. We should just do something.
Which is presumably happening because the technology is moving so fast, people think they need to act quickly to deal with it. But you're right, it can lead to very unwise regulation.
Yes, I think that's right. There's this idea of a hype cycle. The firm Gartner has created this idea of a hype cycle where new technology goes from overly hyped. This new thing is going to cure cancer. And it's the best thing since sliced bread. It's going to be wonderful. And then something bad happens, because something bad always does happen. And that's what they call the trough of despair. And at the trough of despair, some people say, we should completely stop this thing. It's awful. It's terrible. In reality, what you really hope to do is emerge from the trough of despair into what they call the plateau of productivity, which is between the peak and the valley, which is to say, this new technology is valuable for a lot of things. It's not going to cure cancer. It's not going to be a cure-all. We should properly regulate it to make sure that its downsides are minimized, but let's capture the upsides. And I think in some areas of tech policymaking, some policymakers are still stuck in that trough of despair without really acknowledging what the positives we want to maximize are.
One of the most scathing critics of parts of the industry, and particularly the company you used to work for, Google, was Shoshana Zuboff. In her book, Surveillance Capitalism, she maintains that the ad-driven model is entirely evil. She even at one point says that Mark Zuckerberg is responsible for more harm than the Spanish conquistadors, which I found extraordinarily hyperbolic. Do you have a response to that basic idea?
I think it's pretty elitist, to be perfectly honest. Ad-supported services have allowed those services to reach more people. I subscribe to the New York Times and the Atlantic and other paywalled services, but they are, by definition, elitist services. The other primary model is doing things via ad-supported services. I also think a lot of privacy activists like Shoshana Zuboff have completely failed to grapple with the consequence of this point of view, which candidly is less monetary support for news in particular. Because most newspapers have actually depended on things like programmatic targeted advertising that is targeted to you and what you're interested in. The last 10 years have seen privacy activists wage a kind of a global war against targeted advertising. And the effect, honestly, that it's had is attacking the revenue of news organizations, particularly smaller news organizations. I don't think that's really well understood. I also think the reality is that the number of people who are actually concerned about what Google and Facebook might quote unquote know about them and the way in which they then target ads based on that is very, very small. And I think the people in that small, let's say 5%, have always felt like more people. They always want more people to be concerned, to expand their 5% to be larger. But the reality is most people just aren't concerned about privacy in that way. There are people concerned about privacy, but then I looked at services like Signal, which is very popular for privacy reasons, or even Snapchat, which is popular, particularly among teenagers, also for privacy reasons, but not in the same way that Shoshana Zuboff is concerned about, which is, I don't want the company to know that much about me. It's much more about, I don't want other people to know that much about me.
I don't want my parents to know much about me.
Absolutely. Teenagers have always wanted privacy from their parents. That is arguably a bigger truth in privacy and a more widespread feeling about privacy than I don't want Facebook to show me a targeted ad. And I think that that's not ever been fully appreciated by policymakers, that people do want privacy, but just not the kind that generally the privacy activists push for.
So Apple is famous for apparently respecting the privacy of its users more than other companies. Maybe you can bring our listeners up to date with what has happened recently in the legal system in America with a push by part of the Department of Justice to constrain some of what Apple's doing.
Sure.
Why are they doing it?
Well, we have to rewind a bit. In 2019, the U.S., which has two antitrust enforcement agencies, the Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice, they struck a deal. And they said the FTC would investigate Amazon and Meta, and the Department of Justice would investigate Google and Apple. There was no real principled basis for this division of labor, except for the fact that both agencies saw the possibilities for big headlines. And I think it was inevitable. Once you divvy up companies in that way, you really are starting with your target, and then you're trying to figure out what kind of case to bring. Again, I don't think that's the most principled way of doing this, but that's what they did. Over the last 4 years, seeing these enforcement agencies bring cases against Amazon, against Google, and against Meta, Apple was the one of these four targets that hadn't yet had a case brought against them. Simultaneously, Epic Games had brought its own private antitrust case against Apple, really over its management of the App Store and the commissions that Apple collects on in-app purchases. They brought that case. It was heard in California 2 years ago. Apple largely won. The courts essentially were very reluctant to change the terms of the App Store management. They found that Apple had pro-competitive justifications. They also found that Apple competed with Android. And so this question of the App Store has largely been dealt with by federal courts in a way that Apple has generally prevailed. And so I think that left the Justice Department casting about for other topics to sue Apple over. What they largely ended up with was a case that's really focused on how Apple manages its operating system for the iPhone, iOS, and particularly the integrated nature of it, the walled garden nature of it, which isn't as open to outside services as maybe some would like, but has always been that way. And that's really the part of the case.
There is this complaint about the tech companies that, yes, there's more than one of them, but by and large, the squelch genuine innovation that takes place outside of their groups, because, for example, they will often acquire companies that are small and innovative, and in that process, shut them down rather than actually using their services. And secondly, if people do have an app that adds real value on top of the platform, sometimes it does end up having awkward hurdles to jump over to get into the stores and to continue having a financial viability. Do you have any sympathy for that view that says that we have to keep prompting big tech to allow young upstart companies to have a fair crack of the whip?
Yeah, I do. But I also think it's kind of important. What are you talking about? For example, one of the complaints that has been made for years is from a company called Tile, which does the tracking devices that you can attach to your keys, for example. And then if you lose it, it's connected to your phone and we'll help you find that. They've argued that Apple's treatment of them is unfair. Now, their complaints didn't make it into this case, but Apple has a service called Find My Phone. It's also, they have AirTags. And the way that AirTags work is using the network of iOS devices, creating essentially a network to help you find your device. And that's how it works. Should that be open to Tile? I don't necessarily think so. I think that Tile itself has its own privacy security infrastructure that they need to deal with. Apple has taken a lot of steps to make sure that AirTags can't be abused. There's always this question of making sure that an AirTag isn't surreptitiously placed on someone. Could they ensure that for a third-party service like Tile? So I think that you start off with this surface-level claim. Well, they should be open. But then once you kind of go the next level down, you sometimes have a competing value that comes into play. And again, in the case of the iPhone and iOS, it's always been this very integrated experience, which is different from Android.
One of the things that the DOJ has done is to declare that Apple has more or less a monopoly of a market category called performance smartphones. Do you think that's a reasonable market definition, or do you think it's a regulatory conjuring trick?
I think it's the latter. You almost always see in government antitrust cases the government gerrymandering or jerry-rigging the market definition. And you saw this in the FTC case against Meta. They said that Meta operates in a market called personal social networking that didn't include LinkedIn because that's professional, and it didn't include Twitter because that was something else. They do this in a way so that they can show that the target dominates the market. I think that market definition is vulnerable to attack in court because what Apple will say, and I think credibly, is that Apple devices compete in the marketplace against Android devices. Android is actually way ahead in Europe. In the UK, it's more neck and neck. In the US, Apple iOS probably does have a slightly larger share, but nowhere near the 70% plus that you typically see in monopolization cases. And I think that the actual market share of iOS in the United States might be more closer to 55%, 60%, which is not nearly high enough really for a case. And I think that the competitive presence of Android is going to be a weak spot in the DOJ's case against Apple.
So should Google be cheering on this case, or is that short-sighted if they would do that?
Here's my perspective on it. For the last couple of years, Google has been pretty vocal about how non-iOS messages are treated in iOS. What's described in this case is the green bubble issue. If you're using iMessage and if you're messaging with another iPhone user, the messages show up in blue because they're encrypted. If they are coming through an Android device or SMS, they're coming up in green to signal that they're not encrypted. And Google has complained for several years that this is discriminatory against Android users and makes them feel like second-class citizens. It might be a reason why particularly young people choose iOS over Android. Interestingly, outside the U.S., a lot of people scratch their heads at this argument because the truth is that outside the U.S., everybody has responded to this conundrum by just using WhatsApp instead. And so this idea of the blue bubble, green bubble is sort of uniquely American. And the extent the DOJ talked about social stigma, I don't know that social stigma is enough to base an antitrust argument on. So because Google has been concerned about this, they might on the surface like that aspect of it. On the other hand, if Apple lost this case, then I think Google would face the same legal theories used against it on search. The heart of this case is this idea that Apple has what's called a duty to deal, that it owes something to other wallet providers like banks or other smartwatch providers like Garmin. And if Apple were to lose, then the same theory would be used against Google to help Yelp get guaranteed access to its search results or TripAdvisor. So I just think it might be a short-term gain, but long-term loss.
Most of the commentary I've seen about this case concludes that it's going to last for 10 years. And then nothing much will have happened, and or the tech landscape will have moved on so far that it's completely and utterly irrelevant. It will be a textbook case of regulatory action being fighting the last year's war and losing it as well, probably. Do you think that's right, or do you think that it could surprise us and there might be some near-term dramatic consequences for Apple?
Well, it's interesting because prior to the Biden administration, U.S. antitrust enforcers had generally a bias towards bringing settlements and striking settlements with companies. And so they would investigate and they would go to the company and they'd say, well, we're prepared to bring suit. Let's talk about a settlement. And for the most part, companies would engage in those settlement conversations. Apple's actually had those settlement conversations with regulators around the world, in Japan and parts of Europe, and it's actually settled. It's settled on this basis with the number of governments around the world. But one thing about the U.S. antitrust enforcers, Jonathan Cantor at the Justice Department and Lina Khan at the Federal Trade Commission, is that they're both part of this neo-Brandeisian anti-monopoly movement. And one of their core tenets is that settlements were too deferential to the companies. And so their mantra is to bring more lawsuits. Now, the risk in that is that the enforcers lose those lawsuits. I think they probably will lose most of these lawsuits, actually. But that's the vibe that they have right now. And they would prefer to launch a multi-year, somewhat quixotic lawsuit and maybe lose than to strike a settlement that would yield some positive incremental results. And that's their choice. And one of the interesting things about this is that this case probably won't see a courtroom for 3 years, probably. And by then, Jonathan Cantor, the Deputy Attorney General who brought this case, will probably not be at the Justice Department any longer. And so they don't have to own the consequences of what actually happens in the case. They get to have their moment where they say they brought the case and don't really have to face any consequences if they lose.
So this is a pretty depressing view as to the caliber and the motivation and the operations of the anti-monopolists.
Yes, it is. I agree.
Is there anything more positive you can say about them?
Look, I think that the anti-monopolists would be well advised to focus on the monopolies that have a clear negative impact on consumers. For example, the Department of Justice has simultaneously been investigating Live Nation and Ticketmaster, which merged several years ago. There's always been a concern that they use that monopoly to muscle out rival promoters and venues and ticketing services in a way that's detrimental for consumers. There's a fairly large grocery merger before the FTC, and to their credit, they have challenged it. And I think that's a good one to challenge because there's a very clear argument that a grocery merger probably does end up reducing choice and increasing prices for consumers. On the tech cases, they are very far removed from theories of consumer harm. And in most cases, they've been driven by competitors and smaller supplier companies coming in to complain. So I just think in some ways the enforcers have been sort of driven by this idea that all these big tech companies are just great targets. You get great headlines for taking them on, as opposed to really thinking about, is this something consumers want? Are consumers really clamoring for this? Is there a clear case that this is detrimental? So I do think that the anti-monopoly movement probably would benefit from more focus.
Yeah. Let's look further ahead. And as David intimated in the introduction, at the moment, most people, most consumers are slightly uneasy about the rapid advance in AI and related tech. They're not paying very close attention. And I think a great number of them would really rather it all went away, which obviously it's not going to do. It's going to continue and it's going to accelerate. There may well come a time when there is a possibly quite sudden upsurge in demand for something to be done to make sure it's safe and quite possibly stop it. And at the moment, big tech doesn't necessarily have the public on its side, certainly not the left and probably not the right. And even in the middle, I think a lot of people are instinctively slightly against it. What do you think Google, Facebook, and the rest should be doing to position themselves for this quite likely onslaught of fear against technological development?
I draw interesting examples from the push for autonomous vehicles. We work with several autonomous vehicle companies. And I'll tell you what I have observed. Whenever you do a public opinion survey, would you ride an autonomous vehicle? Are you excited about an autonomous vehicle? Most people say no. They're not excited. They would not ride in it. And I think that's a manifestation of exactly the kind of fear you're talking about. But on the other hand, when you talk about a technology like autonomous vehicles, there's always been some people beyond the tech optimist crowd, senior citizens, the blind, people who don't have access to great transportation options, who are very, very excited. And what I've seen happen in autonomous vehicle development, companies like Waymo and Cruise have really tried to roll out their services in a very incremental, thoughtful way. Waymo started operating in Phoenix, Arizona, in a small area, and they learned a ton. They learned an incredible amount. They would run into scenarios that they had never seen before. And then they took those learnings and reprogrammed the car software to deal with that situation next time. And then every couple of months, they'd expand their service to more and more parts of Phoenix. And then they expanded to the airport. And they're now going to expand to highways. And now they're expanding to other cities. And they've learned. I was struck last week. I saw a video from San Francisco where Waymo operates. A video posted by the San Francisco Fire Department of a fire engine driving down the street. And a human driver who's supposed to pull over did not pull over. But what did pull over? The Waymo car right next to it. The Waymo car, which did not have a driver in it, had figured out how to detect a siren and lights and pull over. Now, that is brilliant engineering. Now, Waymo's been at this for 10 years, a long time. This, to me, shows the benefit of getting tools out there. They're not going to be perfect. Some people are going to be scared by them. That's understandable. We should get tools out there to experiment and learn and improve. And there's going to be screw-ups along the way. And we should have grace and understanding about those screw-ups, because it's those screw-ups that are going to make the service better, more accessible, safer for everybody. I don't ever want to dismiss the concerns people have, because I think it's completely normal. And by the way, one of the things you also see in AVs is that once people try them, they love them. And they almost become boring. And I think that will be true of AI too.
It'll disappear into the background.
It will disappear. Look, Gmail auto-compose or auto-reply, which a lot of people have, that's artificial intelligence at work. And right now, nobody really knows that because it's kind of just there. It's great. It's ordinary and kind of boring now.
But self-driving cars are an unusual category because Google did have some competition. It had Cruise from General Motors.
Yeah.
And before that, it had Uber, which was developing its own program. But they didn't have an awful lot of competition. And the competition, and indeed Waymo, had to move slowly because it was enormously expensive. Because perhaps unusually for the tech industry, it was colliding with the real world. It wasn't just putting software onto smartphones. It was actually changing the car population. Now, that's inevitably going to take a long time. Massive, enormously expensive process. So they could afford to go slowly because they didn't have a lot of competitive pressure to go fast. If you contrast that with large language models, which are the thing which is scaring the living daylights out of some people now, they don't have those constraints. You can launch one immediately and hey presto, everybody's got it. And then somebody else can come along and launch one the next day. And that is indeed happening. Large language models show that things can happen much more quickly if it's just software. Should big tech be preparing itself for an onslaught against that kind of development?
You raise a good point. What I've observed is that the big tech companies are actually operating more cautiously probably than the startups. They have more to lose. They have more reputation to lose. I think the best example of this is Google had already built its own version of ChatGPT, but they got kind of bogged down internally and they were concerned about the scenarios where it might be abused. And so they were slow to roll it out. Once ChatGPT was rolled out by OpenAI and people's imagination, Google was playing catch up. What I think is interesting is that there clearly is already room for companies to take different approaches, some to go really fast, some to go more slow, some to promote caution as their way of operating. Adobe has a generative AI tool that creates imagery, and its promise to its customers is that they only have trained on licensed images.
This is Firefly.
Yeah. Other services are adopting a policy of fair use and training on any available service, any available imagery. So Adobe is going out to customers and they're saying, we're not going to have any legal problems. Now, I'm a champion of fair use. I don't think the other model actually has legal problems either. But my point is that you have in the marketplace companies with varying levels of caution, and that's okay. That's good.
You can imagine a situation where the call that Max Tegmark made, the Future of Life Institute, to stop the development of large language models, they called for that pretty much immediately after GPT-4 came out. It caused a lot of debate, but it didn't get the moratorium that they were after. You can imagine a moment when GPT-6, GPT-7 comes out and that call is renewed. And actually, by that time, the public's got concerned enough that they back the demand and they demand that their politicians implement it. I could quite easily see that coming. And the big tech organizations spent an enormous amount of lobbying. And in some ways, I don't think it's working. Nick Clegg, apparently, I've read, gets paid $30 million a year to make Mark Zuckerberg public friendly. And I don't think it's working. Mark Zuckerberg doesn't seem to be very popular. Is there more that they could do? I guess they should be working more closely with you.
Well, I don't think it's about making executives more popular. The way I would think about it is this idea of we got to pause it all reminds me a little bit of, again, just what I've seen in autonomous vehicles, which is cities saying that we have to just stop it all. And if we stopped it all, we wouldn't learn from the edge case scenario where a dog runs out in front of the autonomous vehicle and we learn how to deal with that situation. Look, Google recently found itself in the midst of a controversy because when you ask Gemini, its tool for imagery of Nazi soldiers, they showed Black and Asian Nazis, which is clearly not historically accurate. But you can understand why, because there was a concern that if you asked an image generator to show you images of a CEO, that because most company CEOs are male, that it would show only men, and that would reinforce a bias that we don't probably want to reinforce. But obviously, in the case of showing racially diverse Nazis, that's just ludicrous. This was a situation where all this unfolded in public, and Google admitted it made some mistakes. So it's going to go back and recalibrate and try to fix those mistakes. I think that's positive. I think all of that is a positive debate for us to be having. People talk about AI safety. Well, safety is in the eye of the beholder with respect to these things. There's a lot of cases that we can and should debate about what is the right way for an AI tool to operate. And I just think no one has all the answers figured out. It's better to figure those things out through these kind of situations rather than say, nope, it all has to be stopped and paused.
So you're not advocating any heavy-handed approaches? You're advocating taking the time to bring the public along in an understanding through incremental developments and to encourage some, I think the words were, grace and understanding rather than trying to pigeonhole things into some simplistic big tech, bad monopolies, bad whatever.
That's right. And I'm just very wary about policymakers who advocate broad sweeping solutions to problems because I think it just deprives us of the chance to debate and learn about particular cases.
Is there anything you'd like to say at the end to wrap up? Things that maybe have been missed from our conversation that would help listeners to understand the future of tech policy and regulations?
No, I think we actually covered a lot. Nothing else comes to mind, really.
Actually, I have one question maybe we can slot in.
Sure.
What do you think of the EU's AI Act?
I don't think very highly of it. I think that the EU has been very quick to try to address every single possible thing that might possibly go wrong with AI before necessarily any of those things have gone wrong. In the US, we've taken more of an ad hoc approach to see what goes wrong, what's the right solution, and to legislate accordingly. I just think that's a better approach. Some people sometimes say, well, Europe is leading the world in technology regulation. And yet, it's not leading the world in technology innovation. And its regulation is probably the biggest reason why. I'm sorry, but Europe is not leading the world. Europe is lagging the US in technology innovation, and its regulatory approach is probably the biggest reason why.
Many of us absolutely agree with you that Europe is not taking a part in the development of AI that it really should be. And indeed, the rest of the world, you know, Africa, the rest of Asia, apart from China, South America, and so on. But I'm not sure that the regulatory process is the reason for that. We just don't have the companies that can do it. We haven't got the single market in the way that America has and China has. There's a bunch of other reasons. But it is ludicrous to say the EU is leading AI. As you said, it's just leading regulation, and that's a totally different thing.
Many years, I go to the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, and there's an area of CES that's called Eureka Park, and it's highlighting startups. For several years now, France has had a major portion of Eureka Park highlighting French startups, and they're very organized. The division of the government that aims to promote French startups is very effective. And yet, you don't ever hear of any of these startups becoming success stories. And I think, why? To me, it's just so striking that no one in the EU takes the time to investigate this or work on it.
People do. And the single market is a big part of the reason why.
Absolutely.
If you're in Paris and you've got a great games startup, if you want to sell it in Italy, you've got to get involved in a different language, an entirely different distribution system, a different regulatory system. And until we have a single market in the EU, it's going to be very, very hard for startups to scale, to blitz scale in the way that companies can in America and China, which is why Brexit might actually, in an odd way, turn out to be a good thing, because it's demonstrating to the rest of Europe that leaving the EU is a really stupid idea. And it may enable the single market to consolidate more quickly.
Yeah.
Jury's out, but that might possibly be a consequence.
But for as much energy as the EU has put into things like the AI Act and the Digital Markets Act and the Digital Service Act, which largely have focused on this idea of constraining the US big tech platforms to sort of give European platforms a leg up, that hasn't really played out either, to be perfectly honest. Imagine if all that energy was put into the project you're describing, which is a true single market for Europe's digital startups. That would be, could be transformative. Harness the power of the EU bureaucracy to make things easier and to create more opportunities for European tech startups. I mean, that would really be incredible. But no one seems that interested in this.
From your lips to God's ears.
Adam, thanks very much for taking the time to come and talk. We didn't spend much time on the Apple case, in part because there didn't seem to be any strong, powerful motivation behind it, rather than just good old-fashioned politics, which is a bit of a pity. But we certainly had lots of other angles to pursue in this discussion. And I say to our listeners, if you disagreed with some of what was said, if you want to come along and defend the action of the DOJ, or have another view as to how industry can thrive more quickly in Europe, then please get in touch and we may feature that on a forthcoming episode. So thanks again, Adam.
Thanks, Adam. Fascinating conversation.
Thanks for having me. It's a great conversation.